Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Master. Today we will start out with Laura Poitras, who's the director of the Academy Award-nominated documentary for Best Feature Documentary, My Country, My Country.
Hi, Ian. It's great to be here.
And it's a pleasure to talk to you. And, of course, your film, I think, is certainly the most powerful and interesting and incisive films about the war in Iraq, given that we don't consider the Iraqi people, and certainly we don't count them as casualties, and we don't consider their suffering. And it's truly that, you know, obviously we are responsible for it. The film, in fact, sort of starts out early in the film when you see the doctor going about making tea in the early morning with distant explosions rumbling through the city. And then his friend drops by and he makes that sardonic joke.
Yeah, he makes a number of sardonic jokes. I think he says that this is the fruits of democracy, you know, these sort of moments of, you know, bombs are going off and here we have the fruits of democracy. And then I think there's another moment where he's in his clinic and his colleague says that this is actually really the plan that we had, that's to create chaos in Iraq, keeps the fight there and keeps it away from us. And I think that that's sort of a... unfortunately, a sentiment that a lot of Iraqis share.
That really is a method to George Bush's madness, in other words?
Yeah, you know, I mean, actually, I don't think it's actually that well planned out, actually, the way...
Oh, of course it's not, but it, yeah, I can see from their point of view...
It would be, yeah.
...that we have visited hell on earth upon them.
Yeah, I think so, and I think that this, you know, now that we have, you know, now there's all this conflict with Iran, and it's a very bit peculiar because it's sort of a predictable outcome that if you have a majority Shia, you know, country that has strong ties with Iran, that if we, you know, bring democracy or implement, if you had democratic elections, that those are the people who would ultimately form the government, which is what's happened.
Tell me about how did you get to Iraq? Obviously, you've got to get there under the auspices of the U.S. military. First of all, what possessed you to essentially risk your life to go to a war zone?
Yeah, you know, I mean, people always ask that, and I really think that, you know, future generations are going to both want to know both what happened during these times and also what did we do, you know. And I'm a filmmaker. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I can actually make a record of what we're doing, and it seems to me that this war is a radical departure for the United States, and that it should be documented. And I really felt compelled to do that, and I also felt compelled to do it in a way that that we can feel this war. You know, that we're not just hearing body counts, but actually understand what does it mean for people who we come to know and come to love. And I think that there's just the media is never going to do that, and the type of filmmaking I do can capture just really the human cost of what's happening there. So you know, I think I went there with, you know, a desire to document this big neocon project of bringing democracy to the Middle East. You know, how are we going to do that? And then we've sort of given the U.S. military the task of doing it, which is something they're not trained to do. And I felt that was the original, that was my starting point. And then once I got into the country, and I was then that's actually when I met Dr. Riad.
Now you met at Abu Ghraib, didn't you?
Yeah, I had been in the country for a couple of weeks, and I was still looking for the type of filmmaking I do, cinema verite. So you need the characters that are who do you follow to tell the story? And I was still looking for those people, and I'd gotten access to go to Abu Ghraib to film an inspection that was being conducted by Baghdad City Council. So it was a group of Iraqis that were inspecting the prison for medical reasons and other reasons.
But from the outside of the fence, though?
No, it's actually, that is inside
Abu
Ghraib.
Oh, that's inside. Oh, I see.
Inside Abu Ghraib and that you see in the film. And also, this was probably about 2 months after the torture photographs were public everywhere. So this was, to get into Abu Ghraib was pretty unique to be able to be there. And so they were allowing Iraqis to come in and speak to the detainees. And at the time I was there, there were probably 3,000 men being held, many of them over a year. And Dr. Riad was leading the inspection. And so he became the protagonist of the film. But it was at the scene that I met him. Mm. At Abu Ghraib, and you actually see in the film as he's talking to men, and the way that the camp was set up is that there were these enclosed areas behind razor wire and fence, but there were many, many of them. And so they kept going deeper and deeper into these other, you know, these other areas until eventually they find this group of juveniles that that you see in the film.
Including a 9-year-old boy, right?
Including a 9-year-old boy, yeah.
You've obviously won Dr. Riad over, but the point being that he risked his life to take you in.
Yep.
Because if anybody in the neighborhood knew an American was living there, you would have been dead, and so would the family. And so it was a two-way street. You both had to protect each other.
Yeah, I mean, he was. This was somebody who was participating in political, on local politics in Baghdad City Council, and so he was risking his life every time he left his house. I mean, there have been, as we know, hundreds of assassinations of anyone who's involved in political and work, and then to take an American into your home on top of that, it's just a very courageous man. But it's interesting because I'm sure that people in his neighborhood knew because I was there for long enough and filming long enough, but I think that because I was with somebody who was very respected, that there was a certain group of people that knew that I was there but didn't turn me in or didn't, double cross.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura Poitras, who's the director of the Academy Award nominated documentary for Best Feature Documentary, My Country, My Country. And this is an extraordinary film. Certainly, in my opinion, the best film that's been made about Iraq, since it does actually deal with the country, the people who live in the country, the people that perhaps we overlooked when we went in there. Perhaps we were more concerned about what was under the ground than who was living above the ground.
There's actually two films on Iraq that are nominated, which I think says something about sort of and both of them look at Iraqis, so it says something about the lack of that in the mainstream media. I mean, here we are debating Iraq, but there are no Iraqi voices that are being brought into this conversation. So, but it's extraordinary, and sadly, the situation is right now that it's that the United States is not really providing visas for Iraqis. So, unfortunately, Dr. Riad will not be able to come to attend on next Sunday. But he actually is going to be, I think, on the phone here with us today.
He's going to be on the phone in a few minutes, as a matter of fact. He's at an undisclosed location. He managed to get out of the country, and it is an abiding tragedy that a million, I think it's up to a million Iraqis are living in Jordan, and an equal
more,
number.
I think it's up to 2 million externally that
right.
fled, and internally another 2 million. So we're talking 4 million of a country of 25 million displaced. It's really, the lack of support for refugees is heartbreaking. I mean, it's that we're not doing anything to help people who are trying to flee and whose lives have been threatened.
But can you imagine that? Just extrapolating on that condition to our lives here in the United States. Imagine living in a country where somebody comes in from abroad and wrecks your country to the extent that you can't even live in your own country.
Right, and Dr. Riad, I mean, he is one of the. He never left under Saddam. I mean, he stuck it out under Saddam and the sanctions and the wars, and said he would never leave. And he, at some point, decided that it was unbearable. That he was a week after he got out, he sent me an email saying that four of his friends, they had been found dead with drill holes in their head. I mean, this is what's happening to people there.
And what do you think explains this absolute bestiality that goes on, this murderous lust that's based, from what I can understand, on a religious division? And it's obviously a tit for tat cycle.
Yeah,
but the level of the animus is just incomprehensible.
I really think that you have to look at when you look at the violence there. You have to say, okay, here's a country that hasn't had. That has been living in a power vacuum now for 4 years. I mean, since the U.S. came in and disbanded, the army and the government, there really hasn't been a government that's been, that's legitimately run the country. So you really have what I think is a situation of anarchy that I think would happen in most societies if you had a power vacuum, for as long as you have. In addition to that, you also do have, the tensions and that, longstanding divisions among Sunni and Shia, but it never was like. I mean, I think everyone will tell you, Iraqis will tell you that they, there's, families are intermarried. I mean, there's the two communities are intertwined, And now this level of violence, I mean, I think it's there are so many factors. I mean, there's criminals, there are terrorists, there, you know, they're provoking this. There's, you know, I think a huge amount of sheer resentment towards and retaliation against the Sunnis and, you know, who were part of, you know, the Saddam regime.
And one of the things that's always struck me as being obscene, that here in the land of the free and the home of the brave, we have accepted censorship. We our news it has been sanitized. The rest of the world, particularly in the Arab world, via Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, see this carnage close up and personal on a daily basis. We don't ever see dead bodies of American soldiers, nor do we see the casualties of this war. The overwhelming number of Iraqis, up to 700,000, who have died, innocent civilians. So we've accepted that. Now, if you don't go that route in the film, but you do portray the American soldiers, and in many ways they come across, it's sort of so tragic that they seem so earnest, but completely out of touch with what to do and what's really happening.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that, you know, once you sort of you witness, I mean, their lives are on the line, and they've basically been given an impossible task. You know, I mean, they're absolutely their targets every time that they, you know, just by being there. And then they're being asked to do, you know, to win hearts and minds, or do nation building. I mean, things that they're really not trained to do. And and, you know, and then I would, you know, you'd see people trying to make this work. And I think that they're, you know, that it's just incredibly tragic predicament that the military has. And I think that at this point, I recently did a screening at a war college. They wanted to see the film and to sort of understand what they were missing. And so many people came up to me and just said, you know, why are we, you know, just a sense of despair about the war, the direction of the war, and that they're being left with the bag, you know.
These are U.S. military officers who, in fact, are seeing your film in order to understand the hearts and minds dimension of what, and they're about to be deployed in Iraq, right?
Yeah. I mean,
they're not too happy about it, by the sound of it.
No, I mean, the screening that I just did, actually, it was not of guys that are being deployed. It was actually war planners. So these are people who have to, like, actually come up with strategy. And they're this semester, they're looking at my film and the Battle of Algiers.
Oh, really?
As two films to look at, just to understand better, you know, how to deal with insurgency and counterinsurgency. I mean, the level of pessimism that I heard, I mean, it's really, it's such a difficult predicament. Mm.
Well, I think in many ways the problem is that I think most reasonably objective and intelligent and observant people know that this thing is a catastrophe. I think the majority of the American people know it's a catastrophe, and it's just that our leaders, the president and the vice president, I think, are such cowards that they can't admit that they've made a terrible mistake, and they don't. So they're in denial, and they want to pass this mess on to the next guy.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be. And I'm surprised that people aren't more outraged about the nature of this kind of cowardly leadership we have in this country that would put us in a situation like this, and don't have the guts to admit that they've made a mistake and pull the plug on this tragedy, which just compounds itself every day. Your film, by the way, I'm being didactic and editorial. Your film doesn't. It's much more subtle than what I'm saying here. And we're also joined by Dr. Riad, who is the star of the film, if you will. He's the principal focus of the film, My Country, My Country. He's an Iraqi medical doctor, a father of six, and a Sunni political candidate in the elections that took place a couple of years ago. And Dr. Riad has managed to get out of the country, but we were talking earlier about, Dr. Riad, that you can't get a visa to come here to the United States to be at the Academy Awards, which does seem rather incomprehensible that we're supposed to be liberating Iraq at the same time you can't come here to be with Laura, just as a visitor.
Thank you. It's so difficult to have an entry visa to the United States nowadays for many difficult issues. One of them is the passport. Our passport is not valid.
I see.
And we have to change the passport, and this became an international problem, that the Iraqi refugees now, they have no passport, and the other country, they don't deal with their passport because it had been cancelled, and the government has no choice, to no alternative to have a solution for this problem. Second, it takes time to have a visa to the United States. At least it takes at least 1 month or 2 months to have a visa, and with this shortage of time.
And so, I think that the U.S. is not really welcoming Iraqis. I think in the last 4 years since the war, yeah, we've allowed in less than 500, which is when we realize, you know, the translators who have risked their lives, you know, to work with Americans, and we're not really providing any refuge for Iraqis.
Mm. Yes.
And Dr. Riad, in the film, you come across as an Iraqi patriot who's trying to navigate this extraordinary chaos as your country disintegrates around you, and you're running in the election, and you're under personal risk to do so. But can you give the American audience something that's never discussed in the coverage of what's happening in Iraq? From the Sunni point of view, why is there a resistance? What's the fundamental reason why the Sunni feel it necessary to take to arms? At least not all of them, but enough to make this what is called a civil war.
This film is not taken just to enjoy the people and their holiday. But this film is a documentary film to document all the events that had happened to an occupied country and the mistakes that had been done there, and if we can correct some of them. The election done there was in a very difficult circumstances. Violence against the Sunni cities. It wasn't like an aggression. The Sunni people refused to participate in the election because they regard this as, and this is a reaction from them against the occupational force, and they regard this election under the occupation is not a suitable media for the election, because everything could not be transparent and it will not be justified well. So, but we work during that difficult circumstances. Believe me, now when I saw this film again, I'm crying, because I can't get like that circumstances now in comparison between 2004, 2005 and now. At that time, I can't move. In spite of the risk, I can't move from one place to other. And I can speak, and I can explain to the people, I can educate the people, I can negotiate anywhere. Now, I can't do anything of this. Even the movement had been a very limited movement, and we will be a target for anyone, any sectors, any militias, any parties, anyone to use violence against the people working in the field of democracy, peace, and elections.
That's extraordinary. That as grim as the circumstances are in the film, it's relatively a paradise compared to the current condition. Your children, your daughters, of course, feature in the film so much, and they they got out with you, and they're all safe. But you, in terms of your personal family, you've lost members of your family, right? I think, well, in the film, of course, one cousin is kidnapped.
Yes, this is an event that happened to me and the Iraqi people also. The kidnapping process was. And how we dealt with that problem at that time, and how we lived that critical days in a phobic condition, that one of our family had been kidnapped and he might be killed, and we have to collect money for the kidnapper to give them the money without any guarantee, but we succeeded to have my relative to be returned, but later on also another one had been killed when he visited his aunt in another neighborhood.
Yeah, it was his name. His name is Mustafa. He was studying also to be a doctor. He's a really fantastic kid. I would stay with Dr. Riad's brother, and you know, and would talk with him. And he was just so smart and so wonderful. And you know, he was gunned down in front of the family on over the holidays. You know, over Eid. I mean, it's the tragedy. You know, the whole family was there.
But Laura and Dr. Riad, it seems to me that this is such a deep tragedy, in the sense that this country that we've broken, the best and brightest, the educated, the professional people, the people who could be the people that could build this country, and they're having to get out if they can, and you've somehow managed to get out. What's left? I mean, isn't this called a brain drain? But it seems to be worse than a brain drain.
Yes, and this is the big mistake which had been done after the change of Saddam regime. They had been dissolved the National Army. They had been dissolved the Ministry of Interior, and they used the de-Ba'athification procedure to let the Ba'ath people away from the government, even if they are qualified. And all the qualified people had been taken away from the government. So the re-establishment of the government had been taken on a sectarian behavior and parties. The army had been established as a sectarian people, and it became a militias, and Ministry of Interior also, it's a group of militias, and they are now a killing team in spite of their protecting the people. They are doing now whatever they want to change everything, but the infrastructure of this establishment was on a wrong basis. It had been to be dissolved and re-established again according to qualification. We have qualified people in the army, in the police, and everywhere in our country. Our country has nations. It is an ancient of year that had been lived, had been established in our country, the Babylonian, Sumerian, and we have a good history. Qualified people we have now, to reuse them in establishment of the government, the National Assembly, the ministries, and everything, it will return. Iraq can be returned to stand again during these difficult circumstances.
Well, you know, one of the chilling statistics is that prior to Saddam's coup, the standard of living, according to the United Nations, in Iraq was higher than the standard of living in Portugal. So it's a country that has been functioning in the past, and now, of course, it's shattered, and it's our responsibility.
It had functioning at that time, when the price of the oil barrel was $20, and now it's about more than $50, and we have shortage in everything. We have shortage of fuel, infrastructure, water supply, electricity.
Right. Makes you want to do the math there and figure out what happened to all that money.
Yes, because who are using and controlling the money?
Right.
This is the ministries and the wrong person in a wrong position. They are spoiling our resources, especially financial resources. We are spoiling all resources now in security, and the security is not controlling them now, in spite of all the expenses that had been expended on that condition.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Riad, who's the principal focus of the film My Country, My Country, a film made by the director who's also with us here today, Laura Poitras. The film is nominated for the Academy Award in Best Documentary Feature. And I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Riad. I'm sorry that you can't be here for the Academy Awards. Your presence would be, it will be missed. And Laura, thank you so much for your film. Any last word, Laura?
I just wanted to let people know that actually, unfortunately, Dr. Riad can't come, but Khatam Sahar, the singer
it's a wonderful song, yeah.
who's from Iraq and probably the most famous singer in the Arab world, is trying to get a visa right now as we speak to come to the Academy Awards. And he's an astounding musician and composer and singer, and he wrote the most exquisite piece of music for this film, and so he will be able to come, which is wonderful.
Right, the lyrics for the song?
Yeah, it's called, Dr. Riad, do you know it in Arabic? He says, oh my country, you know, may you have a happy morning. Right. May someday, you know, sadness set you free, you know, my country. And, you know, when he sings a song, anyone who speaks Arabic, I mean, tears come to them. You know, it's so moving. Yes. It really is.
I thank both of you so much.
In Arabic language, it means? In Arabic language?
Yes.
أنا أدعوكم لمشاهدة هذا الفيلم الوثائقي الذي هو يسجل لمحة من تاريخ العراق خلال فترة الاحتلال وأسباب العنف وأسباب تدهور الوضع الأمني في العراق لعلنا نجد تصحيح لهذا المسار ولهذه الأخطاء التي حصلت في الماضي والتي سجلت في هذا الفيلم أشكركم شكرا جزيلا. My daughter wants to speak 2 minutes.
Oh, she wants to speak? I will put her on quickly.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I think this might be a CEO.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Could you identify yourself to Laura? She wants to know which.
I think it's Asil. Is that the Asil?
Yeah, my name is Asil. I'm the second daughter of Victoria.
And I guess you'd like to be in Los Angeles next week, right?
I wish.
Yes. Well, I enjoyed seeing you in the film. Do you have a quick message to the American public here, the American audience?
Quick message. Yeah, I want to say hi, America. First, I have a bad opinion about the American because I saw the USA Army, and now when I met Laura, I know that the American people are the good people, like Laura. They are very kind people, and beautiful hearts.
So you're trying to figure out the difference between the beautiful hearts of the American people and the American government.
That's about the people, the normal people.
Well, I thank you.
You know that I live in Iraq with a phobia and a fear from everything, especially my father, who is working in a dangerous field. And until now, we are worried about him because he has a weak heart. He needs the operation.
So you got out before your father did, right?
Pardon?
You got out before your father. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's safe, and that. Well, look, I thank you all for joining us, and I particularly thank you for your message to the American people. And I think Laura is a very good exemplar of an American. And I thank you for joining us. I thank Laura, and I thank Dr. Riad.
Thanks.
Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Laura Poitras, the director of the Academy Award-nominated documentary feature, My Country, My Country. The star of the film, Dr. Riad, joined us from an undisclosed location. He managed to get out of the country, and his daughter, who's featured in the film, also was able to join us. And welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking now with Chris Hedges, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning veteran war correspondent who writes about religion and politics. He's a graduate of the Harvard Divinity School and the author of the just-published American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. In this book, Chris Hedges, who grew up in the rural parishes of upstate New York, where his father was a Presbyterian pastor, attacks the Christian fundamentalist movement from the point of view of a believer, as someone steeped in the Bible and Christian tradition. He shows us that the movement's yearning for apocalyptic violence and its assault on dispassionate intellectual inquiry is laying the foundation for an unrecognizable fundamentalist America. Chris, just to begin, I guess maybe we're lulling ourselves into a false sense of security here, but there's a general sort of feeling that maybe the Christian right is in retreat, and based upon the election results in the last midterm elections, it does look as though the Republican Party is becoming a white, southern, Christian fundamentalist party, and that maybe they are in retreat. Now, what's your feeling in terms of having spent the last couple of years going to revival meetings and understanding getting to know the televangelists who are behind this movement, and of course the political people who both are in bed with them and either use them or believe in their doctrines?
Well, I look at the engine of the movement as despair, personal and economic, and you know the gross distortions that have been created in American society, the disenfranchisement of the working class, the assault on the middle class, the creation of an American oligarchy where the top 1% now have amassed more wealth than the bottom 90% combined, have given rise to this mutation. And I also look at the Christian right as a mass movement. You know, having traveled around former manufacturing centers in places like Ohio, you know, there are now huge pockets of the United States, and we saw glimpses of it when the press decided to show it to us after the devastation in New Orleans, that look like the developing world. These people are working for wages at two-thirds less than what they made 30 years ago in a steel mill without benefits. The safety net has been pulled out from under them. Their schools are dilapidated. Their communities are physically crumbling. The downtowns are boarded up. And that has brought the usual kind of problems that you get when communities disintegrate, which is alcoholism, drug abuse, broken homes, domestic violence. And they have become ripe fodder for these demagogues who promise a world of magic, who promise a world of miracles, who say that Jesus will take care of you and Jesus has a plan for you. And I think that we have to look at the root causes of this movement, which is despair. And until we ameliorate that despair, until we begin to re-enfranchise these people back into American society, there is no way to blunt this movement. And I think you're very right, Ian, that a lot of people have looked at the 2006 elections and breathed a huge sigh of relief. But, you know, we are rapidly creating the corporate state, an oligarchic state, and these are the rise of a religious theocratic party. The drive to create a so-called Christian state is risen out of the vast mutations that we visited on the American landscape.
And Chris, just further to this point, do you believe that since the majority of the American people are waking up what a catastrophe the war in Iraq is, and the last two people on the planet apparently will to realize what's happening are George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and perhaps the reason they're continuing this agony is that they quite simply don't have the guts to admit that they made a mistake and they want to pass this mess on to the next guy. But the long and the short of it is that it seems to me that the only core support that the president's got left for this total misadventure and catastrophe in the Middle East are the Christian fundamentalists, who actually believe this is a step on the path towards Armageddon. So they're invested in this chaos. So give us a sense of whether or not you think that that's the core that's giving Bush aid and comfort as this disaster continues.
I think relations are actually quite strained between Bush and the Christian right. Ironically, they feel that Bush has not been radical enough. That he, you know, abortion, for instance, 6 years into the Bush administration is still legal. You're right that they, you know, the worse things get, the better they They believe it is for their this strange eschatology of the end times and an Armageddon and apocalyptic violence. And that, of course, is not just limited to wars in the Middle East, but includes, environmental disasters and economic meltdowns. I mean, these, for them, all presage the return of Christ, the rapture, which, of course, is not even in the Bible. I mean, I think one of the reasons that I'm able to sort of piece together what this movement is about and is because I am biblically literate, and I know what they make up and distort and how they grossly misuse the Bible to formulate this ideology. So you're right that they look at chaos as a benefit because, in essence, what they've done is embrace a theology of despair. Nothing in this world is worth saving. It has as its final aesthetic violence and that twisted belief that massive catastrophic violence can be a kind of purgative or cleansing agent in the world. And I think that this, the engine of this movement, really does not depend much on George Bush. There's been some falling out with Bush over the issue of immigration. There's a huge nativist element within the movement, a real backlash, hostility towards immigrants. But of course, the corporations, the corporate state, loves illegal immigrants because it's cheap labor that they can abuse. And when, we saw the immigrant bill come up, Bush sided with the corporations. And I think it's important when you mention Cheney and others to understand that this is an alliance. And it's an alliance between neoconservatives, who I suspect, frankly, laugh at the Christian right, people Cheney, like Cheney, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, this group, but of course they need them because they propel forward an ideology that allows them to essentially strip away the state and make it a handmaiden of corporate interests, destroy regulatory and social service agencies, reduce the state to the protection of property rights and homeland security, and you'll see moments when, as we did on the immigration bill, where these two alliances come into conflict. And I think what we've seen now is a kind of frustration with the Bush administration. The corruption scandals also were important. And the movement is, of course, it all but controls the Republican Party, but I think it's probably going to go out and search for another candidate who has a little more resolve in their eyes than George W. Bush. That may be Brownback. I don't know.
But so, Chris Hedges, again, the author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. Chris Hedges has been a war correspondent for the New York Times and others, mainstream newspapers for some decades, covering 20 or 30 wars. And we're talking about the war at home between Democratic tradition of the United States and this incipient theocratic movement. Of course, the big lie about the founding of this country is that it's a Judeo-Christian nation. In fact, the founding fathers were reacting to the religious wars in Europe, and the separation of church and state was meant to protect the state from the church, not the other way around, which is the way it's been interpreted. But something you brought up here makes me want to sort of try and zero in on this, Chris. In the media, we have these phony populists like O'Reilly and Hannity and Limbaugh, who are put up there by people like Rupert Murdoch to confuse the working people of this country into believing that these guys are on their side, when in fact they're filling them with poison and right-wing vitriol. And it's created a kind of nastiness in the country where they're bitter and angry and they love to laugh at tree huggers and people who really are decent and compassionate and whose instincts are the ones that the prophet Jesus was trying to encourage. So I understand the media and the media oligarchs have unleashed these people to divide, the Reagan Democrats off from the Democratic Party, if you will. But I take it from what you're saying is that the corporate interests who control this country and who want to basically turn it into a well-regulated corporate state with elections as a kind of American Idol kind of decoration that goes on every 2 years, the notion is that if you can get everybody hooked on this mercantile fundamentalist Christianity, again, it's bread and circuses. They won't notice that their jobs are being outsourced, that they're being downsized, etc.
I think that's exactly right, and that's why it's so effective. I mean, totalitarian movements always remove followers or believers from reality-based belief systems. That's what they do. And, you know, that's been true for, and we saw that in the 1930s. I mean, there's this wonderful little passage, I'm just a couple sentences I'm going to read from Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarians that I think explains this world of miracles and magic and creationism and everything else. And she writes, "Before they seize power and establish a world according to their doctrines, totalitarian movements conjure up a lying world of consistency which is more adequate to the needs of the human mind than reality itself, in which, through sheer imagination, uprooted masses can feel at home and are spared the never-ending shocks which real life and real experiences deal to human beings and their expectations. The force possessed by totalitarian propaganda before the movements have the power to drop iron curtains to prevent anyone's disturbing by the slightest reality the gruesome quiet of an entirely imaginary world lies in its ability to shut the masses off from the real world." And I think this is precisely what's happening through Christian television and radio. There are tens of millions of Americans who are now locked in these hermetic systems of indoctrination. They get their entertainment, their health and beauty tips, their news, their spiritual guidance, all filtered through this ideological prism. And it is creating essentially two parallel Americas. I think after spending 2 years traveling around the United States writing this book, I came away with a belief that I no longer live in a country where the majority of the citizens embrace liberal democratic values. And let me just go back to something else you said about the separation of church and state. And of course, you're dead right about the intentions of the founding fathers, most of whom were deists. But I think we have to begin to think of this not as the separation of church and state, but the separation of party and state. What this movement would like to do is infuse the state apparatus with the ideology of their belief system and make the state an agent for the propagation of that belief system. And we're already seeing it. It's a slow process, and in some ways imperceptible, except that the moves made, you know, through this administration and certainly 20 years ago when these people were on the fringes of American society are immense, so that we now have government agencies such as that deal with reproductive health or climate change or UN agencies that deal with reproductive health. I mean, the United States now votes 100% of the time with the Islamic Republic of Iran on reproductive health issues. We're already turning over agencies to these people. And of course, the Bush has worked very hard to stack the courts with people whose loyalty and fealty is not to the Constitution, but to this bizarre distortion of Christo-fascism.
And I understand this hermetically sealed world. I mean, I've gone into Christian bookstores, and I understand it's extending even further from getting your news, your information, your entertainment, your beauty tips. It won't be long before, and in fact, they do network. You know, you go to a Christian repair store, have your car repaired at a Christian car store. How do you understand the kind of the sort of gullibility of these people that buy into this system, at the same time that the people who really are the televangelists, it is so absolutely flagrantly clear, and the record shows that these people are just hucksters. They're rolling in dough, and they're fleecing these people, and some of them are just like Jimmy Swaggart. They end up being caught with hookers, and then recently this sort of nice guy with a big grin turns out that he was having gay sex and methamphetamine with a male prostitute at the same time proclaiming family values and being the head of the National Council of Evangelicals.
Well, what's happened is that they are hucksters and demagogues, although very charismatic ones often, and they've figured out, they understand the ills of American society perhaps better than sometimes mainstream American society understands those ills, and they know how to manipulate them. They understand how desperate people are. I think we do have to distinguish between the believers and followers. My heart was sort of broken when I listened to the stories of these lives before people found Jesus and got locked into the embrace of these mega churches, which are little, despotic fiefdoms in their own right, run by male leaders, for which, and there's always a huge personality cult around them, and they can't be questioned because they're in touch with God and they live lavish lifestyles, and everybody thinks that's great because that's what God wants. But I think that many of these believers are earnest, decent people who we as a society abandoned and forgot about. And that great book by Thomas Franks, What's the Matter with Kansas, asks the question, how is it that these people vote against their own interests? I would argue that they're not voting against their own interests, that the Democratic Party sold them out, two decades ago when they realized that corporate America was quite willing to fund both parties. NAFTA was imposed upon us by a Democratic administration. Welfare was virtually gutted by the Clinton administration. So on economic issues, these parties are completely in sync with these mega corporations and quite happy to essentially fleece and disempower the American working class. And of course, now there's an assault on the middle class. Anything that can be put on software can be outsourced: engineering, finance, architecture. What is the American worker told? The state doesn't intervene in any way to support or protect them, and the new Bush budget cuts even more, deeply into the bone. Including abolishing a program that gives bags of groceries once a week to shut-in elderly poor. They're told that if they want to be competitive, they're going to have to begin to put up with, they're going to have to accept conditions that people who work in sweatshops in the Philippines accept. And of course, I think that loss of hope, but more importantly, when they look at their children, the realization that there's no hope for their children really makes them ripe for manipulation by people who promise them prosperity and protection and worth and so I don't fault the followers. You're right, they're terribly gullible, and I think some of the stories you tell are even funny. They're funny from the outside, not on the inside. They're just sad. But I went to the $25 million Creation Museum in Kentucky for this chapter about creationism on the War on Truth. And there was this display of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with dinosaurs with saddles on them, because, of course, everything was created at the same time, the same six-day period, and dinosaurs and Adam and Eve lived together, and the dinosaurs didn't eat Adam and Eve because everybody was peaceable before the fall. But then, of course, there's a question of how T-Rex got such big teeth, and it's explained to us that T-Rex had really big teeth because they needed someone to be able to crack open the coconuts.
How did they fit them on Noah's Ark?
Well, that is explained in a huge display in a replica of supposedly what Noah's Ark looked like. They put the dinosaurs on the Ark by only putting baby dinosaurs on the Ark. So there are little displays of baby dinosaurs cavorting with like cows and horses and giraffes and stuff like that. and it's the patent absurdity of it on the one hand. And the deadly seriousness with which these followers embrace this belief system. And I think that the rage that is expressed at critics of the movement and critics of the belief system is a rage of people who fear deeply being pushed back into the despair, into a reality-based world that betrayed them and that they can't cope with.
Meanwhile, they're being betrayed by hucksters.
Of course. They're being completely manipulated and used, but that's nothing new. I mean, that is, by its very definition, what totalitarian movements do. I mean, there's a kind of suicidal, self-immolation that comes with these kinds of movements that ultimately embrace this horrible, catastrophic, apocalyptic violence. I mean, German fascism would be the classic example. I mean, it was willful suicide, and I think that's a quality this movement shares. I mean, the fact that they insist that global warming isn't real, I mean, you know, the fact that they welcome chaos and the unraveling of any kind of peace agreement and the expansion of wars in the Middle East is a kind of suicide. I mean, I think in sort of theological terms, what this movement actually embraces and what it is in love with is death itself.
The price you pay for having a liberal society is, for example, pornography, which is all over the internet. And I can understand good people out there in the red states being appalled at this toxic influence on their children. So there's a lot of reasons why you understand why people want to retreat into this hermetic cocoon of righteousness. But the way it seems to be, I'm just sort of extrapolating on what you're saying, that this is the cynical corporatists. This is bread and circuses for them, so that as they rape and downsize the American worker and kick the middle class into the working class and the working poor and the people in the service industries, as they go global, we know the consequences are that of all. It's very clear that the only beneficiaries of the new productivity is capital, not people. People,
right.
And capital transcends borders in the Adam Smith sense. So that we already are creating this international strata of mega rich. And there's no question that the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer, particularly under this administration who essentially represents inheritors and investors. So as they get them into the churches as a kind of palliative from the reality of what they're really doing and get political power through their kind of the obedience of these people, at what point do they wake up? And my fear is that when they do finally wake up and realize they've been fleeced in the ultimate sense, then they're likely to turn to a cornpone Nazi.
Well, I don't think that they do tend to wake up. I think that they, you know, this movement fulfills a deep emotional yearning and need. And I think, in fact, things can get worse and worse and worse. And I thought that actually was portrayed very well in the movie, the German film Downfall, about Hitler's last days in the bunker, where literally Berlin is falling under the onslaught of Russian artillery around the bunker, and yet everybody sort of clings to the fear. It's based on the diary of a secretary, and having lived in places like Yugoslavia that essentially committed collective suicide through these ethnic nationalist movements,
which is what's happening in Iraq by the look of it too.
Which is what's happening in Iraq. I think, in fact, that emotional pull is so strong that people are willing to even accept their own individual and collective annihilation. I think that's something that Freud understood, and I think Freud was correct, that death or the death instinct, which he calls Thanatos, has a deep, seductive, and alluring power. And I think that when we look closely at the radical Christian right, that is precisely what it's about.
Well, but isn't it true that Chris, that death and violence and war, in a sense, is easier than love and compassion and sacrifice?
Exactly, and precisely, and you know what they've created is through, and of course we as a country now speak to the rest of the world almost exclusively in the language of violence. And it is a binary world of blacks and whites, and it makes it easier to cope with moral ambiguity when you simply embrace a belief system where moral, where any kind of ambiguity is eradicated. And I think the other important thing is that, you know, that anxiety of moral choice, for making a moral choice, is removed once you enter this system, because these leaders tell you what is right and wrong in the eyes of God. And that has a deep attraction. They also give you a moral license to hate and even kill certain segments of, you know, within your own country, whether that's, you know, on the fringes, sort of gay, you know, attacks, hate crimes against gays, but of course the demonization of Islam and Muslims. And so you have this rage from people who have been dispossessed and broken, and it's channeled. You know, the kinds of things that are said about Muslims in this country, I don't think could be said about any other ethnic group. I mean, they're patently racist and deeply frightening. And I speak as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East and speaks Arabic. So I think that there are many attractions to essentially surrendering your will and becoming submissive, especially if your life has not been going particularly well outside the walls of those mega churches.
So how do you navigate "Thou shalt not kill" with the support that the fundamentalists have for the Bush war policies, and a good chunk of the military, by the way, are born again, and particularly in the special forces, they tend to be the best of the American soldiers and more sensitive to the local people. You know, one of the sad things that's happening now in Iraq and with the U.S. military is they're scraping the bottom of the barrel, such that we're letting people out of prisons. And really dangerous people are armed and dangerous, and it's appalling what's being done in the name of this country. So give me a sense of how they can bridge this the difference between "Thou shalt not kill" and "Onward, Christian soldiers."
Well, they create a world where only believers are worthy of moral consideration. It's a world where you know, you have a battle between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. I mean, when they speak about Islam, they call it satanic, and they talk about how, in order to bring the kingdom of God on earth, the forces of Satan must be vanquished completely. And, of course, that means physically eradicated. I think what's so toxic and frightening about their rhetoric is that they infuse almost everyone who doesn't subscribe to their belief system with they demonize all of these movements, and that includes, you know, feminists and scientists and liberals and people like me who they would call nominal Christians.
Right, we all know that the lesbians were responsible for 9/11, so at least according to Pat Robertson.
Yeah, I mean...
Just in closing, Chris, can you describe your previous book so people get an idea of your, dare I say it, oeuvre?
Right. Well, the first book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, comes out of almost 20 years as a war correspondent around the globe, mostly for the New York Times, and it's about the poison that war is and what it does to individuals and societies, as well as, of course, the deep attraction. I think that war is probably the most powerful narcotic invented by humankind. The next book I did, What Every Person Should Know About War, is a question and answer book, and it's been used by a lot of in anti-recruiting tables at schools. The Quakers use it. It's modeled on a book, an anti-war book that came out after World War I, and it asks fundamental questions. I wrote it with a bunch of combat vets, including 4 West Point grads. It asks questions that I think, you know, that soldiers or people who are thinking of going into the military often do not articulate, and all of the source material is taken from Army manuals, Army psychological studies, the combat surgery textbook, of which there are only 7 copies in public circulation. And then the third book, Losing Moses on the Freeway, is much more directly related to my own background as a seminarian, where I take each of the 10 commandments and use them as a lens to look at American society, although in a very iconoclastic way. I was very influenced by the Polish filmmaker Krzysztof Kieslowski and his 10-part series, The Decalogue, where, for instance, in when he addresses the issue of adultery, the woman's not married. It's just a series of carnal relationships without love. And that appealed to me very, very deeply, and I took the same kind of approach. And then finally, American Fascist, the Christian Right, and the War on America, which posits that this is not a religious movement. It is a very frightening mass political movement that bears within it many of the fundamental tenets of classical fascist movements.
Given that you're a veteran of the New York Times, and we tend to sort of rather offhandedly trash the mainstream media, and I think it's unfair to I'm sure you've got a lot of colleagues that do a good job, and we should be careful about that. But obviously, the American people, I think, don't feel they're getting the truth here and enough information. And look at all the documentary filmmakers whose documentaries are becoming successful. I think that's happening largely by default, because I think the television itself is such vacuous infotainment.
Yeah, I think that, as somebody who's worked in the media now for over two decades, it's terribly frightening. I've seen how, first of all, the media has been corporatized. I think 80% of American papers controlled by six or eight corporations. Television has been destroyed as a news medium. It's all about gossip, trivia. It's
and Nicole Smith, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really frightening, and there are just fewer and fewer outlets to turn to. And of course, we see a direct assault. I think NPR doesn't quite have the edge it did when I worked for it, but we see now a direct assault by this administration against PBS and NPR. And what they would like is essentially all of us to be tuned into Fox News, which isn't news. It's a form of propaganda. It's a form of indoctrination. So that, to the extent that these pockets of independent media exist, it's absolutely vital that we keep them alive, because they are asking questions, such as you do, Ian, that at this point, however well-intentioned many people in mainstream media will be, can ask because of the corporate ownership and because of the fact that straying too far out of the center or challenging the powers that be means that you're going to have your voice shut down. I mean, look what happened to Phil Donahue at a very highly rated cable show, Question the War. He was off the air almost instantly. So there are huge voices in American society that need to be heard. There are issues that need to be talked about. And unfortunately, given the state of American media, that's probably only going to happen on independent media.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Chris Hedgeson, for your book, American Fascist, the Christian Right, and the War in America. And again, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me in.
Bye-bye. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Cook, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.